Good morning. Good morning and welcome. I want to start, as we often do, with a land acknowledgement that when we gather on Treaty One land in this part of the nation, this part of the continent. Would be more helpful to think that way for me. As I'm looking out the window this morning at the snow and the change of the seasons, I'm imagining the life of people for whom the rhythms of those changing seasons were more impactful than they are for most of us now, and of how the things that people believe, the things that we believe, evolve. We'll talk about this more another time, but they evolve to take the shape of the settings we're in. Which is one of the reasons I think why resolving things like treaty agreements in the 21st century is really tricky, because we're resolving agreements in a different setting than the one in which they were made. And I want us to take a moment just to hold in mind this morning First Nations leaders who have different points of view about how to move this forward. Of course, of course there are different points of view in the First Nations community as well as any other community, but that all makes this complicated for everybody. So just that this morning around the land acknowledgement. I want us to take some moments to breathe together this morning. And again, an invitation, not a thing we're obliged to do, of course. And what I want us to do if we're participating in this morning, or what I want to invite us to do if we're participating, is to do a little exercise with our hands as well as our breath. And just a way of being present to the moment and present in our minds and our bodies and in spirits in an integrated way. So invite you, if you're breathing with us this morning, to take your hands and cross your arms. Put one hand on either shoulder. And we're going to do five rounds. So five breaths in, hold your breath, cradle your breath for a count of three, and then breathe it all the way out. So for me, that's a count of six. And with each of those breaths, just take whichever finger you're on and touch it against your shoulder. So your hands are not touching your body when you begin. So breath one, your thumb goes down, and then breath two, your index finger, and so on and so forth, all the way through. All right. And again, just a way of, it's a way of integrating body and mind and being as present as we can to the moment that we're in, even with all the disruptions, including a glitchy live stream. So let's start there. All right, here we go. So hands, arms crossed. So hands are on your opposite shoulders. And then we'll start in with a deep breath in all the way down to the bottom of you, and for a count of three, and you cradle your breath for a count of three, and then we will exhale all the way, and breath one is your thumb touching your shoulders. Okay, here we go. All right. Thank you. I don't know about you, but I needed that this morning in a big way. Okay, what I want to do this morning is start with a bit of a mind exercise. Don't panic. this will be, if the word exercise feels like, how hard am I going to have to work? This is actually fairly simple to do. So this is going to all happen. Everything we're going to do here, you know, happens in your mind's eye, so in your imagination. So one of the things that sometimes helps us if we're doing something imaginative is to close our physical eyes, so we're not actually looking at the things around us, which is one of the important ways we take in information when we're imagining things. So I would say invite you to close your eyes. Close your eyes because that kind of helps you turn inward. I realize that not everyone's in a situation where they can close their eyes without things, you know, going sideways maybe around them, especially if there's little people involved. So you might have to come back to this or proceed in another way. But in any case, That's my invitation. So close your eyes if you can, if you're somewhere where that's a plausible thing to do. We're going to take a little walk forward in time. Little walk forward in time. We're going to imagine that you're going somewhere. You're traveling. I was going to say Venice, Italy, because they seem to have solved their flood problem. But this is just a little weekend jaunt, so let's say Vancouver. So you're going to Vancouver. You go to the airport, you get on the airplane, you get settled. And the pilot comes out to say how good it is to have you all on board and nice to be traveling again and to wish you a great flight. And you have a great flight. You get to your destination, you go to your hotel, you check in, you go out for dinner. And the couple at the table next to yours is they're clearly in love and they're just so happy together, and it makes you feel like love is everywhere. The room is full of it. They've just gotten engaged and their delight in one another is just sort of spilling over to the whole place, and it feels great. It just feels awesome. And the next day, you decide you're going to wander around and find some music that feels like it sort of fits the vibe of the trip you're having. And so your hotel's a little bit towards downtown. You wander down toward Granville, and on your way, you pass the historic Orpheum Theater, and you see on the marquee that the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra is presenting an evening concert. That evening, it centers around Elgar's Cello Concerto in E minor. You think that sounds great. And so you stop at the box office and you're able to get some tickets. And that evening, you put on your fancy duds, which you just happened to bring along, and you make sure that your phone is on vibrate and you don't have any noisy cough candies, and you head out. The soloist does not disappoint. And you have a wonderful evening with the orchestra and the cellist, and you head back to your hotel feeling replete, maybe a little drained from being deeply present, but also as though you've been transported. You've just been carried somewhere else. And all in all, it's been a really great weekend. Now, you can open your eyes if you had them closed. And this should be a pretty safe way to do this exercise. Like, nobody needs to know your answers to the questions I'm about to ask. This happened in your mind, okay? And even if we were together, I would not ask for out loud answers to this. So don't answer out loud, just internally. This is just for you to know, okay? This is just for you to know. So here's some questions. In your mind's eye, when you were getting settled on the plane, were the people around you wearing masks? When the pilot came out to say hello, any chance that they were black? Any chance that they were female? Any chance that they were black and female? When you went out for dinner, was the happy couple, the just engaged couple, were they a same-sex couple? Or two people that presented in other ways that were gender non-conforming? How about the cellist? Any chance that they were indigenous? And no, this is not a sneak attack in which we are accused of being racist or homophobic or somehow otherwise judged at the end. We may come away from an exercise like this feeling like we have some pretty powerful unconscious or implicit bias to wrestle with, but in our context this morning, it's just an exercise that illustrates that we tend, as humans, we tend to imagine what we're already familiar with. We tend to imagine what we expect to see, what our experiences have taught us to expect to see. In our imaginations, what we're expecting is the way things are. And so when we do a little mind exercise like that, the pictures that are in our mind tend to be ones that are already familiar to us. And that's one of the reasons why change is so challenging, especially change that invites us to reconsider ideas or images that have been ingrained in us over many years. And it's a curious thing to me how we can be aware of things like this kind of inclination for us as human beings, And we can be aware of them as facts that are sort of backed up by research and by studies and tests. We can also be aware of them by virtue of having had an experience like the one we just had, where our own familiar patterns are revealed to us. And even with all that awareness, we can still manage to operate as though sort of none of the above would apply to our spirituality. Now, maybe this is a good point at which to distinguish a little bit between religion and spirituality, because bias and religion can be pretty comfortable together, but bias and spirituality interact a little differently. We've explored this before, but I think it's an important paradigm shift, both in our surrounding culture in general and in religious subcultures broadly, and in the little corner of the universe that is the community connected to the table. Spiritual but not religious, and religion dash none, they become dominant categories of self-identification in our day and age. And for lots of people, including many of us in this community, that way of identifying can mean a pretty wide variety of things. Last week in our music time, when Cheryl was introducing sort of that part of our time together as a community, introducing one of the songs she was going to sing, she talked about the experience of leaving, of moving away from a formative sort of fundamentalist idea environment and the ideas that went with it. And she mentioned, I won't get this verbatim, but she said it then that, lots of us in the community would sort of have similar experiences, which I know is true. It can be confusing to try to separate ideas from people sometimes. And Judy, you weren't talking about this in your intro to your song that you just wrote this morning, but you touched on something really related. We might find ourselves sometimes in these processes of change, of needing to put some distance between ideas that were handed to us, sometimes in quite insistent ways, and the people that did the handing, the people that presented those ideas to us or inculcated them. And I do understand that sometimes systems of belief can be abusive, and so can the people that are, trying to drive them home. And when we have those experiences, then sometimes we need to step away from both the ideas and the people. We need to have boundaries for the people. But a lot of the time, we're in situations where that distinguishing between ideas and the people who perpetuated the ideas is an important and useful kind of separation. You would sort of think maybe we'd be getting a little more skilled at that, all this practice, that we've been having with trying to be close and distant at the same time. I had to run an errand to IKEA the other day, and their little voice over thing that, keeps popping up while you're in the store reminds us to let's stay close, just a little further apart. So words to that effect. So that tension, right? We're practicing that all the time in our experience these days, but it doesn't really seem to get easier. It's tricky. And one of the things that can make that hard is this pattern of seeing what we expect to see or what we are familiar with in our imaginations, in our picturing of the world as we do it in our head. It's about what we picture when we imagine certain categories or ideas or situations, about the way we visualize them or pre-visualize them. And this is, for example, why it can throw people for a loop in a religious environment when God is referred to with anything other than male pronouns, with anything other than he or him pronouns. Now, we've talked about this enough as a community for me to know that we don't all picture God as a male, as a guy. In fact, we don't, as a community, we don't all picture God as an individual at all. A rather important an important truth about us as a community. But, and this is about, again, this is about how we picture things, just try using a gender-neutral pronoun for God sometimes, even if it's only in your own imagination. It's pretty interesting. Just use they, them instead of he, him when you're talking about God. And just see what that feels like in your head. The idea that the divine would be constrained by gender is, in many ways, a pretty easy one to get past, at least ideologically. Even if you choose to hold a belief that the Hebrew origin stories are literal accounts, or you choose to believe those texts as inspired right down to the punctuation, even if you're coming from that perspective, the story still says that male and female are created in the image of God. So clearly, as a bare minimum set of ideas that reference the Genesis stories, if that's where you're working from, our notions about God would need to embrace more than one iteration of gender. That's an example of the idea part of this. But when we imagine God stepping away from the pictures in our head, whether they came from a children's picture book or from decades of Bible stories with visual components or even from our own imaginings of God, whatever pictures are in there that are familiar are at some point going to be part of what we need to acknowledge and consider if we want to continue to evolve our own understandings, our own beliefs, and our own ways of living out our spirituality. And not doing that kind of personal work is to end up stuck in the paradigm we already have, you know, in there. In other words, not doing that kind of work is a short path to not exploring what we believe. This is a little bit of a divergence and something I don't mention as often as perhaps I should, but in our life experience, now, this moment, is not always the right time to go exploring. Sometimes we need to just sit with what we have for a while for whatever matrix of reasons. And even if we take, you know, evolve or die as sort of our mantra for spiritual formation, sometimes we need to acknowledge that as humans, we are not wired for unceasing, unremitting change. And sometimes we need to just rest. And as a community, the table exists to make room to explore what we believe. So those themes of exploration are going to be recurring. And that's why I think it's important to also touch on the other part of the story. We can't chase down every idea we encounter anyway. So there has to be some ways in which we try to discern what is resonant for us and what isn't at a given moment in our lives. And which ideas we're sitting with right then and which ones we're tossing around, you know, which ones feel like they're up for grabs. That's all I'm going to say about that. I'm going to get back to the exploring part, but hopefully to the degree that whatever I have to say about it is a factor, hopefully that makes, you know, that makes a bit of breathing room if it's feeling like it's needed. And it really might be feeling that way these days. There's so much change going on, so much sort of, you know, reinvention. I am going to go back to what I was exploring, but I wanted to stop and have that sort of parentheses about that. In my own exploring of what I believe, even when it takes me into thinking very critically about Christianity, which is my religion of origin, I keep coming back to the teachings of Jesus. Now, what I believe about Jesus, how I would answer that "who is Jesus to me" question, that's changed a lot over the years. But one thing that has endured, one idea that I can personally still, I would say, be at rest with, is my sense that Jesus was a genius illustrator, just a brilliant storyteller. And I get that when I read the Jesus said parts of the Bible, I'm not reading a transcription. I'm reading something that has been transmitted through, in some cases, a long oral tradition that has been written down by people sometimes quite a ways post whatever history was about in that moment. And it's been transmitted and translated. And of course, we can't translate without also interpreting. And all of those things are true about whatever I find in the text as we have it, and as it's arrived sort of at this juncture in history. But even through all of that, there are these moments and sayings that are just gems. There are ideas in there that, from my vantage point, at least keep challenging us as human beings across cultures and across millennia. And I think those moments are actually a huge part of why the texts themselves have kept on being valued, even though perspectives on what they are and why they matter have morphed, you know, a lot in the last while. Anyway, here's one of those gems for me. Jesus is talking to a group of people who keep messing with his project of overhauling his own origin religion, the religion he'd grown up in. And this group that's kind of given that project so much grief, has got a lot of religious power, which they frequently use in self-interested in ways and in ways that reinforce oppressive systems. And at one point, Jesus levels this critique at them. I would have made a fine tweet. He starts by calling them blind guides. Now, that's a powerful image in an age where blindness would have been seen as a curse from God and would have, from a medical point of view, been in almost every case experienced as permanent and socially and economically debilitating. So a very potent image to use the image blind guide as a critique of someone these days would probably have gotten him promptly labeled as ableist. Again, we make beliefs, we make beliefs and language for beliefs to fit the spaces we're in, an idea we'll explore another time. But that's how he starts. He says, you're blind guides. You're leading people, but you can't see where you're going yourself. And then he follows it up with this zinger. He accuses them of straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel. Now, I don't know if Jesus like got kicked or spit on or bit by a camel, had some kind of a childhood traumatic encounter with a camel or what, or if he just thought they kind of looked goofy, but camels are Jesus' go-to for the absurd. When he wants a character in a story that's going to represent like, this is crazy, he goes with camels. And that's kind of interesting in the context of this story. So gnats, of course, are tiny. Flea, you know, and you're kind of on the right track. They were, interestingly, symbolically unclean. And so folks that had religion really wired, who were really serious about keeping the religious rules, would strain their drinking water for them. Not because they were gross to drink. That seems like a perfectly legitimate reason to screen them out to me. Not because they were gross to drink, but because it was against the religious rules to consume one. And so they would carefully filter their water through, you know, through fabric or something. Now, camels are also ritually unclean in that religious system, but, you know, generally acknowledged as much harder to swallow. And so given the combination of those things, the whole picture is just, it's just over the top. It's just absurd. And Jesus is using that absurdity to point to a radical inconsistency, to point to an enormous gap between what these folks professed to believe and judged other people for not believing and the way that they were behaving. They were gnat straining in the interest of right belief, of right moral behavior. This was about codified morality, about the rules that if you kept them would tell everyone that was aware of those codes and of those systems that you were one of the good people, you were an insider, you were legitimately one of the people of God. But the camel that they were swallowing was the massive injustices being perpetuated by that same religious system. They were straining at the gnats of these increasingly minute moral details while swallowing whole things like the judgment and dismissal of people that didn't believe the right things, that didn't keep the religious rules, that didn't express their spirituality in the ways that the religion said that they must, including the behaviors that lined the pockets of the folks at the top of the structure and kept the religious structures operating. Now, it's relatively easy to read a story like that and sort of stand back and go, oh, you bad, bad religious leaders. You know, how could you be so hypocritical? How could you be so terrible to people that trusted you to lead them and so on and so forth? Now, the thing is, from the vantage point of many of the people in the story, the way this whole system worked in terms of their experience of it was just normal. It's just the way things were. And if you would have asked them what the picture of how the world works was in their heads, including the picture of how human-divine relationships worked and how those were mediated by or practiced in the context of religion, it would have been, the picture they would have told you that they saw would have been this picture. It's how we're wired. We see what we're familiar with. And there would have been a few folks that would have seen it differently, of course, for a variety of reasons, and Jesus certainly is in that group. But if people spoke up about it, if they actually said something about that different perspective, the majority would be either in denial about what the sort of nonconformists were saying, or they might even be downright offended. They might be really bugged because it didn't match the picture in their imaginations. This is one of the reasons why when we do a mind exercise like that, first one we did, and we come up against unconscious bias, or implicit bias, we're just naturally resistant to the things that experience might point out to us about ourselves and our beliefs, because it doesn't match that picture. Which is to put it in the context of the story Jesus is telling, we're straining at gnats. We're working so hard, we're making so much noise about how hard it is to deal with some finer point of change or to tilt in the direction of greater equality or whatever. And those points of change are important. Of course they are. We need to work at them. We need to move them forward. We need to work for change. Those things matter. But at the same time that we're making a big deal out of how great we're doing with making progress on straining out the gnats, we may well be swallowing whole camels, without even batting an eye. We might really want people to notice how progressive we are, how current in our beliefs and practices, and at the same time be participating in huge systemic injustices. Now, some of you have probably seen this cartoon that's floating around the internet these days. It's a drawing of a bunch of dinosaurs. They're standing sort of together, looking off toward the horizon. And above the horizon, we see this enormous meteor hurtling toward Earth. And the thought bubble across above the head of one of the dinosaurs says, "Oh shit, the economy." That's the visualized, pithy version of this saying. In the cartoon, the economy is the gnat, and the camel is the future of all of humanity. It's us working hard to prop up the details while we're ignoring the gigantic themes. And sometimes we respond the way we do because we don't know, or we can't even imagine another way. We just can't get there. Sometimes we engage in the details and ignore the giant themes because, well, because they're just too big. They just feel unapproachable. It's overwhelming. It feels beyond our control. And so we focus on what we can see, what we feel we can comprehend, or what we feel like we can influence. And the other stuff becomes the way things are. Which raises the interesting question: how can we break out of that part and see some of the big things that we're just not seeing, or that we're shying away from facing? What can we do to name some of the camels that we're swallowing whole while we're straining at the gnats? If the solution was easy, maybe we'd all be doing it, right? I'm not sure. What I do believe is that even if it's complicated and difficult, there are some pretty good clues about where to begin that are available to us. One clue I think we can find as a community in a song that we sing at the table. It's a song that Tim Penner brought into our community, Adam Cohen's song called "Put Your Bags Down." It's a song that invites us, among other things, to consider the futility of trying to change things by just trying harder at the details, by finding a few more gnats to strain out while continuing to ignore the camels that we're swallowing. The trick, Cohen says in the song, is to be ready to put our bags down. Now, that's a wonderful poetic phrase, specific enough to generate a picture in our minds, but general enough to invite us into the story. Good songwriting. But another way to think about that phrase is to think about it as about being willing to trust that there is more to the story of life here than we can control just by trying harder. It's about being willing to accept the futility of trying to see a future that is beyond our gaze, or trying to hang on to people or things that aren't really ours to possess. And if we must strain at something, it's an invitation to turn our energy towards dealing with our own negative behaviors. To expend our energy on wrestling with other good directives from the genius of Jesus, things like not envying, or not hating, or not living in fear. It's an invitation to do the work of putting down the bags of trying to look like we have it all together, like we know the answers, like we've got all the gnats strained out of our drinking water, and welcoming the freedom of considering that, as the song says, the train is always on time. Now, I want to invite you a little further into the story of that song with the same exercise we started with. The song, as I understand the story, has its genesis in an actual experience that Adam's dad, the very well-known Leonard Cohen, told him about. A story of Leonard being on an actual train and watching an older gentleman struggling to balance all the baggage that he has, that he's traveling with, by holding it up instead of sitting it down on the floor of the train. And the image is that the train is going where it's going either way. And the question is, how can we make the journey better for ourselves and for others? I want to invite us to sort of close the loop on this a little bit, or maybe move deeper into the loop, because it depends what kind of experience we're having, by using a similar exercise as the one we used at the beginning. So I invite you to just take a moment and close your eyes. So visualize yourself as being on a train. I don't know what your train experiences have been like. Maybe you've never had one. Lots of us have never been on a train, but if you've ever been on a bus that's crowded, or on a subway, or if you've ever been in Europe and traveled by train, where lots of folks do this every day, I invite you to picture a train that's busy enough that you're not sitting in your seat. You're standing on the train. You have a number of bags. These are things you care about, things that are valuable, that matter to you. You want to get them where you're going intact. And the train, you know, because it's busy and you're standing in the middle of it, you're not at one of the window seats, and trains being what they are, you can't see what's coming anyway. You can't tell when there's going to be a corner. You can't necessarily tell, as you would if you were driving, when things are going to speed up or slow down. And so this sensation of needing to work to keep your balance is an ongoing one. In the meantime, you're juggling this other stuff, and it's out from your body. It's leveraged against the act of trying to be in balance and be more at ease where you are, be able to travel without being utterly fatigued. In your mind's eye, as you picture this situation, I would invite you to try to imagine how the experience would feel different if you were holding up all the bags compared to what it would be like if you sat them on the floor by your feet. If you just put them down. The train is still, you know, you're still kind of rocking and rolling. You still can't see what's coming. You still have to work to be in balance. But now, you're just balancing you. How's that experience different for you? And then the next question that goes with that is, how are those two experiences different for the people around you, the people you're traveling with? I don't know if you've ever been close to somebody on a train, or maybe more likely in a subway situation or a public transit situation where you really would not like to be close to them. You'd really rather have a little more distance, but you can't because of the circumstance. It would be, at best, it would be rude to try to make that space, and so you stay where you are. How's the experience for the people around you different if you're trying to juggle all the bags as opposed to if you put them down? Well, like with any exercise or metaphor, it's not that hard to shoot holes in that. That's easy. What might be hard is actually putting our bags down. And, you know, for all the responsible ones in our midst, don't worry, we're still responsible for the bags. We're just not responsible for the ultimate destination of the train. This is not within our control. And maybe if we don't try to carry what is futile for us to carry, we'll find that we have more energy to carry what is ours to carry. We'll find that we're more able to pick up the bags and move forward when it comes to our stop. Maybe we'll find that if we stop straining at the gnats, when we get to our stop, we'll have some energy for dealing with the camels, so to speak. Well, I realize that this has been an interesting exploration in the sense that it hasn't been filled with facts or sort of established ideas to push against in some ways. It's engaged with a part of our life experience that can feel kind of mysterious to us and around us. But thanks for giving it some consideration, exploring it for and within yourself. Peace, everybody.